This is Ancient Church History, and this is the fourth session. We're talking about persecution. I'm just going to briefly mention what I just said. Morning, Drew. Persecution is, in general, the harassment to cause suffering based on the religious beliefs of people. But the why of it, when we think of why Jesus died, there is a divine perspective in it and a human perspective. With regard to Jesus' death, God's purpose was nothing less than the redemption of mankind. From a human perspective, it looked like a political expediency on the part of the Jews at the time. When we look more closely at this, we can see that there's a juxtaposition of God's purpose and man's ill will, but God's purpose trumps it all, as we see in Acts chapter 2, verse 23. It was according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God that Christ was crucified by the hands of wicked men. So God is in charge of all of this, and also made the point that Jesus identifies with his believers. Because when he arrested Paul on the road to Damascus, he said, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Saul said, "Who are you?" He said, "I am Jesus whom you are persecuting." Paul was not aware that he was persecuting Jesus, but that's how Jesus saw it. That's the divine perspective. So that kind of brings us up to what we had just been talking about. So you see, Ilona, you didn't miss anything at all, really. There you go. Okay. So the implications for us, besides what I just mentioned, Jesus said, and this is on the outline in the middle there, implications for Jesus' followers. In John 15, verses 18 through 20, Jesus says, "If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. They will also persecute you." Okay, the fact is the world is at war with God. That's one way to put it. Ever since the fall, the world, and I'm not talking about the mountains and the valleys and, you know, the beautiful land. I'm talking about the world as an ordered system arrayed in opposition against God that lies in the control of the evil one, 1 John 5, but not the ultimate control. God has the ultimate control. Nevertheless, the world is opposed to God. So, after excoriating the scribes and the Pharisees in Matthew 23, the seven woes, Jesus then, in a reflective mood, laments over Jerusalem. And he says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who are sent to you, how often I would have gathered you to myself like a hen gathers her brood, and you would not. Behold, your house is left to you desolate." And then he walks out of the temple, and Matthew 24 begins, and Jesus is prompted by his disciples then. Well, what happened was they saw his mood, and apparently they wanted to cheer him up, and they said, "Master, look at these buildings, and aren't they wonderful?" He says, "You see all this? It's all coming down. There will not be one stone left upon another." Well, that, you know, he checked their enthusiasm pretty quickly, and so they then said, "Well, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming?" And when he said the temple's coming down, that in their thinking meant the end of the world. And so then he gives his discourse in chapter 24 of Matthew. It's also in Mark 13 and Luke 21. And what he does is he talks about the wars and the rumors of wars and all this kind of stuff. And then he talks about all of these dislocations, all these whether it's socio-political, whether it is natural catastrophe, earthquakes in various places, or whether it's persecution. They'll deliver you up, and there'll be betrayal and hatred and love grows cold and all this kind of stuff. He says it's the beginning of birth pains. Okay, and so, and then after that, there's one particularly sharp birth pain. He begins to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, and that's there in 24. So what is he saying? He's saying in his lament, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I reached out and you wouldn't have it. You're judging me." They're just about to turn him over, right? And the Romans are going to crucify him. They're judging him, he said, and he's sad because he knows what's coming. You're going to be judged. And the judgment of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple was tremendously catastrophic and tragic. But it's also indicative of the fact that judgment is coming on the world. So, I'm just saying this to tell you, the world is at war with God. The world is at war with Jesus. It put him to death, the death of the Son of God. We just say, hey, I want to follow Jesus. You know, I want peace and joy and, you know, purpose in my life. And, you know, I don't know what led you to become a follower of Christ. And I'm not saying it was something just light and happy like that. But for whatever reason, we become Christians. And he says, well, here's the tough side of it. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. Now, we happen to live in a nation that had a lot of Christian values, and we actually see this starting to dissipate at a rather rapid rate, and we're feeling kind of like, you know, that polar bear on the ice floe, that the ice is melting, and we're, you know, like, what's going on here, and where's this headed? And it can be a little scary. So as we are now going to kind of look at persecution in the early church, I just wanted to give you a little bit of a biblical or a worldview context. This is not something that is some strange thing. This is actually pretty much the way it's been for Christians, for true Christians, through the history of the Christian church. All right? Okay. In the book of Acts, and I'm back to the outline here, this is following the crucifixion of Christ. They're preaching boldly, and Peter and John are arrested and brought before the Sanhedrin for proclaiming the resurrection. Jesus died, but these guys are claiming Jesus rose, and they're doing it boldly. This is a result of being filled with the Holy Spirit. You'll receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you'll be my witnesses. Witnesses, by the way, is the interesting Greek word martyrion, from which we get the English word martyr. A martyr or a witness is so convinced of what he's seen. This is theoretical, that he is willing to die. I saw it, and you know, you can take my life away, but I can't say that I didn't see it because I actually saw it. So these eyewitness observers, the apostles, are saying, filled with the Spirit, are saying that Jesus rose from the dead. Another thing that would account for their boldness is when they saw Jesus rise from the dead, and he said that because I live, you shall live also. They thought, oh, well, things are probably going to wrap up pretty quick here. I'm going to live for him, and if they do kill me, I'm going to rise from the dead too. It happened for him. He said, okay, great. So I'm not afraid. Now, as time goes on and the return of Christ, there's this delay of now over 2,000 years, we can lose sight of the fact that you know, there can be courage for us in remembering the resurrection of Jesus. We're pretty far removed from this, unless we really put our noses into the Bible and really think about it. But this fueled them. And so they're proclaiming the resurrection with great boldness. That's in Acts chapter 4. And then in the next chapter, they get rounded up again And this is the time when Gamaliel interposes. If you remember, he's the one that said, hey, listen, if you oppose them, you're just going to make it stronger. And if there's nothing to it, then there's nothing to it. And so it was good pragmatic advice. It's not exactly sound advice, but it kind of got them off the hook at the moment. So there's kind of a ramping up here of pressure on the apostles. And then things actually get deadly. And that's when the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who couldn't really agree on much, they agreed on this, that Stephen was a problem. And so he is martyred. That's Acts chapter 7 and chapter 8. And if you read this this account, you'll see that he gave the history of Israel, and then, which was good enough. I mean, they're happy to hear the history, but then as he gets to the end of his account in Acts 7:51, he sums it all up by saying, "You stiff-necked people, uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit. As your fathers did, so do you. Which of the prophets did not your fathers persecute? And they killed those who announced beforehand the coming of the righteous one, whom you have now betrayed and murdered, you who received the law as delivered by angels and did not keep it." Well, that was not, you know, if he was hoping to get out of there alive, that was not exactly what you wanted to do, but you have to admire his courage. Well, they become incensed by this, and they stone him. So it's now gotten deadly, and then immediately following that in Acts 8, and Saul approved of the execution, and there arose on that day a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the region. This was the will of God, again, in that sense that there's a divine purpose that's behind it all. And then in Acts chapter 8, you see the apostolic preaching going beyond Jerusalem and Judea and spreading out into Samaria, because it was God's will that this was going to proceed. And so the proclamation of the apostolic preaching, and especially the proclamation of the resurrection. The difference between in this sense, there's a difference between the crucifixion and the resurrection. Crucifixion was a public event. Everybody saw it. Everybody regarded it. Everybody realized that it happened. But the resurrection was not a public event. It was presented only to the eyes of faith. So it needs to be proclaimed and believed, because God works with us on the basis of faith. So it's not just the crucifixion. It's the crucifixion and the resurrection that constitutes the gospel. So when we proclaim Christ crucified, also we're including in that, when Paul said, I determined to know nothing among you except Christ crucified, inherent in that is also an understanding, and the resurrection. Otherwise, what's the point? Yeah. Okay. Okay, things go on here, and Herod Agrippa I, that's the grandson of Herod the Great, kills James, and he attempts to kill Peter. That's in Acts chapter 12. These are just little bursts of persecution. But now in letter E there, the emperor Claudius banished the Jews from Rome, and this included the Christians, because Christianity at this time is still viewed as a subset of Judaism, and I think that would have been in the late 40s AD. Not absolutely sure about that. And then according to Josephus, and you know, he is the Jewish historian who, generally speaking, is reliable, but according to the Jews, he was too cozy with the Romans, so they have a problem with him from that regard. But according to Josephus, James, the brother of the Lord, was stoned to death in Jerusalem in 62 AD. And then there is the persecution under Nero, 64 to 68 A.D. According to a strong tradition, Peter and Paul are martyred at Rome during this time. Paul by beheading because he was a Roman citizen, and Peter by crucifixion. And again, according to a pretty strong tradition, crucified upside down because he didn't consider himself worthy to be crucified in the same manner as his Lord. Well, the big thing about this is the Neronian persecution has to do with the burning of Rome. And so I'd like to read to you a little bit from Philip Schaff. If I can get the right page here. Yeah, there was, this is July 18, evening of 18 and 19, AD 64. There was a great fire at Rome. And with regard to the persecution of Christians under Nero, the occasion of the spectacle was a fearful conflagration of Rome, the most destructive and disastrous that ever occurred in history. It broke out in the night between the 18th and 19th of July among the wooden shops in the southeastern end of the great circus near the Palatine Hill. Lashed by the wind, it defied all exertions of the firemen and soldiers and raged with unabated fury for 7 nights and 6 days. Then it burst out again in another part near the Field of Mars, and in 3 days more laid waste 2 other districts of the city. The calamity was incalculable. Only 4 of the 14 regions into which the city was divided remained uninjured. 3, including the whole interior city from the circus to the Esquiline Hill, were a shapeless mass of ruins. The remaining 7 were more or less destroyed. Venerable temples, monumental buildings of the royal, republican, and imperial times, the rich creations of Greek art, which had been collected for centuries, were turned into dust and ashes. Men and beasts perished in the flames, and the metropolis of the world assumed the aspect of a graveyard with 1 million of mourners over the loss of irreparable treasures. The cause of the conflagration is involved in mystery. Public rumor traced it to Nero, who wished to enjoy the lurid spectacle of the burning of Troy and to gratify his ambition to rebuild Rome on a more magnificent scale and to call it Neropolis. When the fire broke out, he was at the seashore at Antium, his birthplace. He returned when the devouring element reached his own palace and made extraordinary efforts to stay and then repair the disaster by a reconstruction, which continued till after his death. To divert from himself the general suspicion of incendiarism, and at the same time to furnish new entertainment for his diabolical cruelty, Nero wickedly cast the blame upon the hated Christians, who, meanwhile, especially since the public trial of Paul and his successive labors in Rome, had come to be distinguished from the Jews as a genus tertium, a third group, or as the most dangerous offshoot from that race. They were certainly despisers of the Roman gods and loyal subjects of a higher king than Caesar, and they were falsely suspected of secret crimes. The police and people, under the influence of the panic created by the awful calamity, were ready to believe the worst slanders and demanded victims. What could be expected of the ignorant multitude when even such cultivated Romans as Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny, it's a different Pliny, stigmatized Christianity as a vulgar and pestiferous superstition. It appeared to them even worse than Judaism, which was at least an ancient national religion, while Christianity was novel, detached from any particular nationality, and aiming at universal dominion. Some Christians were arrested, confessed their faith, and were convicted not so much, says Tacitus, of the crime of incendiarism as of hating the human race. Their Jewish origin, their indifference to politics and public affairs, their abhorrence of heathen customs were construed into an odium generis humani, haters of humanity, and this made an attempt on their part to destroy the city sufficiently plausible to justify a verdict of guilty. Under this wanton charge of incendiarism, backed by the equally groundless charge of misanthropy and unnatural vice, there began a carnival of blood such as even heathen Rome never saw before. A vast multitude of Christians, were put to death in the most shocking manner. Some were crucified, probably in mockery of the punishment of Christ. Some sewed up in the skins of wild beasts and exposed to the voracity of mad dogs in the arena. The satanic tragedy reached its climax at night in the Imperial Gardens on the slope of the Vatican, which embraced, it is supposed, the present site of the palace and place and church of St. Peter. Christian men and women, covered with pitch or oil or resin and nailed to posts of pine, were lighted and burned as torches for the amusement of the mob, while Nero, in fantastical dress, figured in a horse race and displayed his art as a charioteer. Burning alive was the ordinary punishment of incendiaries, but only the cruel ingenuity of this imperial monster under the inspiration of the devil could invent such a horrible system of illumination. And I just read that so you can get a sense of that. This is the way that Schaff writes. It's, you know, he's expressive, but he's a very good historian. So this was a terrible persecution. It's not usually reckoned as an imperial persecution, meaning something empire-wide. Even though Nero was the emperor, it was more or less just at Rome. And the problem here, as I have it on the outline, is that a precedent seems to have been set by this, that Christians could be condemned simply because they were Christians. And we'll see that coming out in the correspondence that Pliny has with Trajan in a minute. Yes?
So Acts ends, the last chapter of Acts is kind of just before all this happened. And what's the latest New Testament book dated, like John's Revelation? Was that
Revelation be about in 90 AD, in the 90s.
So long after this
eventually. Revelation?
Yeah.
John's Gospel is, I'm talking about conservative evangelical scholars, not higher critics. But John's Gospel was probably around 90. Revelation, Gospel a little earlier than that. Maybe even possibly later than 90 AD, if John in his Revelation has the Emperor Domitian in mind, which he probably does, because he was a persecutor at the end of the first century. Okay.
So why were the reaction to all this by the bishops and that we were talking about?
What were the reaction?
Yeah, bishops and Church Roman Church.
I think they were very upset. I don't know. It was terrible. Peter is writing just before this, and remember, he says, "Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you." So he seems to be, that it is interesting, the fiery trial. And he is writing to Christians at Rome, and they're definitely included.
So in his, Romans his, did not persecute Nero, the bishops of the Roman Church?
I don't think we necessarily have any record of a bishop or elders in the Roman Church that were in, set afire or anything like that. I'm not aware of that. And as to how many Christians died, I'm not really sure how many. But it was, significant enough that. But this was a time when the whole city was devastated. So a lot of people died in the fire, and as far as a few score Christian or however many it was that were also burned, it wouldn't necessarily have made a big. Another thing to remember at this time, the church is not really composed of great people. A lot of slaves. Who cares? That would have been the thought. Okay, when we get to the beginning of the second century, there's some insightful correspondence between the Emperor Trajan and a minor official, the younger Pliny, that I like to read to give maybe a little sense about what it's like at the time. I guess one of the legal issues that obtains here is the requirement that people sacrifice to the emperor. And as I mentioned last week or the week before, the emperor throughout the first century is seen more as a unifying factor, kind of a flag that everybody's supposed to salute. And, you know, so we can all be on the same page. And so when someone, you know, refuses to stand for the Star-Spangled Banner or kneels or whatever or you know, raises a fist, it's like, you know, a lot of people, we don't like that. Why don't you like that? Isn't this, you know, aren't we free to express? Isn't, oh, we should applaud that. Well, some people are saying we should applaud it. Other people are saying, wait a minute now. We need to be on the same page here. And when that's not happening, we get nervous. So I'm even conflicted about these things, you know. Well, the whole idea, if you're going to keep a body politic together, we've got to have unity, and we've got to have it at a pretty high level. Now, is it to be ultimate? Well, remember Jesus said this. He said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and render to God the things that are God's. Render to Caesar taxes, honor, respect, obedience to just laws, but worship? No. No. Render to God the things that are God's. In that brief little statement, Jesus kind of set out the course of church-state relations for the ensuing age. We cannot give ultimate allegiance to the state or to any person. That's why, you know, to the ancient mind, now, if we're going to have peace in the marketplace, we have to have agreement at the highest level, the most ultimate or the most fundamental level. And what developed in Rome over time was that the emperor personified the state, and to sacrifice to him was like saluting the flag. If you're not going to do that, then we got questions about you. All right. Pliny writes to the Emperor Trajan, and this is in the beginning of the second century. It's my custom to refer all my difficulties to you, sir, for no one is better able to resolve my doubts and to inform my ignorance. I've never been present at an examination of Christians. Consequently, I do not know the nature or the extent of the punishments usually meted out to them, nor the grounds for starting an investigation, and how far it should be pressed. Nor am I at all sure whether any distinction should be made between them on the grounds of age, or if young people and adults should be treated alike, whether a pardon ought to be granted to anyone retracting his beliefs, or if he has once professed Christianity, he shall gain nothing by renouncing it, and whether it is the mere name of Christian which is punishable, even if innocent of crime, or rather the crimes associated with the name. We'll come back to that. For the moment, this is the line I've taken with all persons brought before me on the charge of being Christians. I've asked them in person if they are Christians, and if they admit it, I repeat the question a second and third time with a warning of the punishment awaiting them. If they persist, I order them to be led away for punishment, for whatever the nature of their admission, I'm convinced that their stubbornness and unshakable obstinacy ought not to go unpunished. There have been others similarly fanatical who are Roman citizens. I have entered them on the list of persons to be sent to Rome for trial. Get treated differently if you're a citizen. Okay. Not that many people were citizens, like maybe 5%. Now that I've begun to deal with this problem, as so often happens, the charges are becoming more widespread and increasing in variety. An anonymous pamphlet has been circulated which contains the names of a number of accused persons. Amongst these, I considered that I should dismiss any who denied that they were or ever had been Christians when they had repeated after me a formula of invocation to the gods and had made an offering of wine and incense to your statue, which I had ordered to be brought into court for this purpose, along with the images of the gods, and furthermore had reviled the name of Christ, none of which things I understand any genuine Christian can be induced to do. Others, whose names were given to me by an informer, first admitted the charge and then denied it. They said that they had ceased to be Christians 2 or more years previously, and some of them even 20 years ago. They all did reverence to your statue and the images of the gods in the same way as the others, and reviled the name of Christ. They also declared that the sum total of their guilt or error amounted to no more than this. They had met regularly before dawn on a fixed day to chant verses alternately among themselves in honor of Christ as if to a god, and also to bind themselves by oath, not for any criminal purpose, but to abstain from theft, robbery, and adultery, to commit no breach of trust, and not to deny a deposit when called upon to restore it. After this ceremony, it had been their custom to disperse and reassemble later to take food of an ordinary harmless kind. But they had in fact given up this practice since my edict issued on your instructions, which banned all political societies. This made me decide that it was all the more necessary to extract the truth by torture from 2 slave women. In other words, he couldn't believe that this is all there was. So I've got to really find out. Here's a couple of slave women. We can torture them. 2 slave women whom they call deaconesses. I found nothing but a degenerate sort of cult carried to extravagant lengths. I have therefore postponed any... So he's perplexed now. I therefore postponed any further examination and hastened to consult you. The question seems to me to be worthy of your consideration, especially in the view of the number of persons endangered. For a great many individuals of every age and class, both men and women, are being brought to trial, and this is likely to continue. It is not only the towns, but villages and rural districts, too, which are infected through contact with this wretched cult. I think, though, that it is still possible for it to be checked and directed to better ends, for there's no doubt that people have begun to throng the temples, which had been almost entirely deserted for a long time. The sacred rites, which had been allowed to lapse, are being performed again, and flesh of sacrificial victims is on sale everywhere, though up till recently scarcely anyone could be found to buy it. It is easy to infer from this that a great many people could be reformed if they were given an opportunity to repent. Trajan writes back to Pliny. You have followed the right course of procedure, my dear Pliny, in your examination of the cases of persons charged with being Christians, for it is impossible to lay down a general rule to a fixed formula. These people must not be hunted out. If they are brought before you and the charge against them is proved, they must be punished. But in the case of anyone who denies that he is a Christian and makes it clear that he is not by offering prayers to our gods, he is to be pardoned as a result of his repentance, however suspect his past conduct may be. But pamphlets circulated anonymously must play no part in any accusation. They create the worst sort of precedent and are quite out of keeping with the spirit of our age. So do not admit anything that comes to you via WikiLeaks. Wait a minute, I just added that myself. I'm just kidding, that's supposed to be funny, in case you... So what's going on here? Well, this is pragmatic politics. Actually, within their universe of understanding, that's actually very wise counsel. Don't admit any anonymous accusations. Deal with every situation individually. Can't really lay out any grid for how everybody's to be treated. But the point is this. There's no establishment of any wrongdoing. It's simply because they were Christians. The worst they can say, it's an extravagant cult, or a cult, a wretched cult carried to extravagant lengths. They meet together. Now, there were some charges that were brought. One of them was atheism. atheism because you could not point to any statue or representation of a god that they would venerate or worship. That, for all that they might say, that to them amounted to atheism. Also, there was a charge of cannibalism. Why would there be a charge of cannibalism?
You mean?
Exactly. The body and the blood, understood literally. And there was the charge of incestuous and adulterous relations. That resulted from the holy kiss and this calling of one another brother and sister. And the problem was that they did meet secretly. And they met secretly because of fear. And so people didn't really know what they were doing. Now, what's going to happen after this sort of thing, as we saw last week, is you're going to have the emergence of Christian apologists who are bringing forth a defense of the faith, and the addressee is these government officials. So it's not so much, let me give you a course in apologetics so that I can, you know, we can witness to our friends. And no, they're sharing their faith, and that's going on. But it's how to protect or defend the Christian faith from official sanction. You do have martyrs of a men with stature that we have good historical accounts of. Ignatius of Antioch is one of the great names. He was martyred, I think, around 112 A.D. And then Polycarp is another. This is another reason why Eusebius' History of the Church, you get the recounting of the story of Polycarp. I mentioned this a little earlier. If you came in a little bit late, you can check these. These are just some books that, you know, they can be picked up for next to nothing. And if you're interested in studying in more detail the actual, you know, some of the original works, there's some things up here that would interest you. But we need to hasten on here. There was a persecution under Marcus Aurelius, and in 177 A.D. But for the most part, in this early period, we do not have what we call imperial persecutions. They are localized, therefore, a short period of time. There could be, and there were, you know, sometimes extraordinarily terrible things that happened to groups of Christians. But there's the thing takes on more sinister look when we get to the middle of the third century. So Roman numeral 3 on your outline, imperial persecutions, what were some of the causes? Well, there had been amazing growth. Christian faith grew by leaps and bounds for some of the reasons that we had mentioned in a previous lecture, I think the second one. It was coupled with some real problems in the Roman Empire. And again, you know, we're dealing with the history that we have. We really don't know too much about what may have been going on in India or in Ethiopia or in other places where, according to tradition, some of the apostles went. We just don't have much, if anything. But what we do have here is because of the Roman Empire and the spread of letters and the Greek language, you know, we do have a good bit of information here. But in Rome, there's been a sharp decline in economics and moral life. And then with the approach of the 1,000-year anniversary of the founding of Rome, many were reflecting on the empire's problems, and they concluded that one of the biggest problems was a lack of unity. And that lack of unity, one of the biggest reasons for that was the Christianity. They were considered to be the chief offenders. The idea was that Rome's decline was due to the displeasure of the gods and the progress of Christianity. When you get to the 4th century, it's going to, this whole idea, because Rome continues to decline, it's the Christians' fault. This is what prompted Augustine to write his magisterial treatise, The City of God, where he takes this problem on. But here's a quote here from Ray Petrie. The year 249, the 1,000th anniversary of Rome's legendary founding, touched off a painful review by historians, social critics, government officials, and the people themselves of Rome's greatness that was no more. Suspicion that the church was a state within the state, and therefore dangerous. It was indeed true that the church had developed its own parallel administrative infrastructure with its office bearers and laws and councils, etc. So, Decius and this persecution under Decius from 249 to 251 began and stopped momentarily and then was begun again under the next emperor, Valerian. Decius' approach was geared to making apostates rather than martyrs. James Orr writes that he was an emperor of the old school. He was a persecutor, not from impulse, but from settled policy. He honestly believed that the salvation of Rome lay in its old institutions, and that Christianity, as a rival power, could not be too speedily or effectually crushed. He is credited with saying he'd rather have a second emperor at his side rather than the Bishop of Rome. It was during the Decian persecution that the bishop of Carthage, whose name was Cyprian, you may have heard of Cyprian. He's famous for a number of interesting quotations and a tremendously important figure in ecclesiology and the doctrine of the church. He was the bishop of Rome, rather of Carthage. Carthage was that important North African city, not far from Rome. It's the shortest place there where you can cross the Mediterranean from the boot of Italy down to North Africa. And during this persecution, Cyprian left Carthage. He said he was following Christ's dictum, when they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. And so that's what he did. Instead of staying there in Carthage, and he continued to administrate his see from a remote location. Well, as you can imagine, he was strongly criticized for that. However, after the persecution lifted, he went back to Carthage, and then under Valerian, a few years later, he was beheaded. So he did suffer martyrdom in that subsequent imperial persecution, and that had the effect of sealing his stature among the Christians of North Africa. And that would actually become very significant because in the next century, everybody's going to be appealing to him for an understanding of the doctrine of the church. Just mention that as a little digression there. He was one of the martyrs of persecution during this middle part of the third century. Continuing on, Valerian proceeded by measured degrees. His persecution started with a stage that began with the removal of bishops, forbidding assemblies under the pain of death, and then the next stage where office bearers were immediately put to death. And other Christians suffered confiscation, banishment. The Bishop of Rome at this time, Sixtus, was actually beheaded while in his episcopal chair. And as I said before, Cyprian of North Africa was also martyred during this time. Besides the actual destruction and loss of life that occurred during these persecutions, there were, I guess you could say, ancillary effects, and one of the worst of them was in the aftermath of persecution, what to do with the lapsed. The lapsed, you see that phrase there down at the bottom of the page? I have it in italics. The lapsed refers to those people who under duress recanted their faith or signed the libelous, that certificate, after, or received rather, the certificate that authenticated that they had sacrificed to the emperor. There were different degrees or gradations of this. Some rich people would maybe pay someone else to go through the procedure for them, and then they'd get the libelous. Some other people would just say, I don't believe that anymore. And then after the persecution lifts, they want to come back to the church, and then the question is, what do we do with them, and who is the one who says what we do? And this led to, at the time of the Decian and Valerian persecutions, a schism in the church, or as the British say, a schism. And schism, begins to become a problem here at this stage. At this time of this persecution, the name of the schism was called the Novatian. The Novationist schism, after a guy, Novation. I'm going to hold on getting into the problems of schism until probably next week, when we're going to talk about the Donatist schism of the next century, because I wrote my thesis on that, and so I want to. Didn't do it for nothing. I take some time and talk about it. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I can tell you more than you'd ever want to know. But it's very interesting. It's all very interesting. You know, I don't know about you, but as I'm reading this stuff and thinking about this stuff, I'm also thinking about myself and what would I do. Oh, they killed all the office bearers. Hey, wait a minute, that's me. Yeah. Do you really want to do this? Yes. All right. Some of the other effects, these terms will become important. I've already talked about the lapsed. There's another term.
What did they do about the lapsed?
I can just say briefly, they tried to make some provision for people to be able to return to the church. They had different ways of going about it in different churches. But one of the big problems with it was, who makes the decision?
Since all the office bearers who made that decision had been killed. So.
Well, here you have that term, traditor, and there's another term, confessor. Traditors were church leaders who turned over copies of Scripture under duress. That is like a combination of being a traitor and being the most horrible person in the world. It's kind of like it's World War II, and you're in France, and you're a collaborator, and
giving names.
Well, it didn't see. This is the way it gets perceived. It's like, this is the worst thing that could ever happen. You're in the French Resistance. And then you got the Vichy French, the collaborators, and you just think they're the worst people in the world. Especially if you happen to be a confessor. Confessor is a term that's used for those people who suffered under persecution and who bore in their bodies the marks of persecution. And they were arrested, they were tortured in some cases. They somehow made it through, and they come out on the other side, and they are awarded hero status. They have clout. And then there are the bishops or the leaders of the churches. And who makes the decisions about what do we do with the other lapsed? And so you had those that were more hardliners and those that were more lenient. And the confessors said, hey, you cowards, and they, you know, they would tend to be less conciliatory in receiving people back into the church. But then the bishops are saying, look, I'm very glad you were faithful to the Lord, but, you know, we're the ones that God has invested with the authority for guiding the dark doctrine and life of the church. So thank you for your advice, but we'll make that decision. And then there were those that divided up along these lines, and that's where you get schism, you see. But the traditors were those church leaders that turned over the writings. And the writings are very, very precious. They didn't have Xerox machines, and they didn't have, you know, all these bound copies. How many Bibles do you have in your house, you know? I don't even know. I've got so many Bibles, so many translations. I don't even know how many I have. Well, for anybody to have a Bible, you had to be tremendously wealthy. I mean, you had to basically sacrifice a whole flock to come up with the goat skin or the sheep skin to I mean, you know. So these things were really precious. Well, some of the church leaders were able to pawn off heretical writings or maybe a medical treatise or something like that. And because there were some officials that were, they didn't want to kill people. You know, it's just, yeah, give me this and we'll call it square. I don't know if you remember the movie The Fiddler on the Roof, and there's a pogrom that's going on, and the official says to Tevye, he says, there's going to be a little trouble, and he's going to try to make it so it's not that bad. And so it's not like these guys are all terrible, these guys are all good. There's all kinds of shades of gray in between. And so this is the messiness that gets exposed in the during persecution and the aftermath of persecution. It's very messy. You know, we've had our own messiness as a church, right? It's not so easy to sort these things out. So that's one of the reasons, by the way, when you study the history of the church and you see some of the things going on, you're just a little wiser when you are now facing your contemporary problems and you're going, okay, yeah, this is bad, but it's nothing new. And nobody's died here, you know? So let's keep things in perspective. All right, added difficulties among the lapsed. Many of them had no real sense of having denied the faith. Look, didn't Cyprian just go to another city? What's that all about? Was he right? And he said he was doing what Jesus said to do. They persecute you in one city, flee to the next. So it's just a mess. And as I said, there the disagreement on how to handle the problems led to factions, the most serious being the Novationist schism. Okay, Diocletian. This is the mother of all imperial persecutions. In the period from 260 to 300, there was virtually no persecution going on. It's been called the 40-year peace. Persecution virtually ceased. Christianity expanded. Church buildings are now being erected, and many influential people are becoming Christians. This Diocletian persecution was the last and the most violent of the imperial persecutions. Diocletian himself was a soldier. He came to power. He initiated some administrative reforms. The army tripled in size. He moved the seat of government from Rome east to Nicomedia. But this persecution began in February 303 with the demolition of the church at Nicomedia and the burning of the scriptures. An edict was posted. This happened by degrees. It was very well planned out. I believe reading about a Christian soldier that saw this edict posted, and in his anger he tore it down, and for doing that he was himself martyred, roasted over slow fire. That's when they really want to make a statement. Slow fire. I mean, you know, it's just, this gets pretty grim. I could go into more detail about it, but this is why Schaff is good if you want to read about some of the details of how this happened. In 305, and this persecution went on for a long time, for about a decade. In 305, Diocletian abdicated, and Galerius, who followed him, and who was probably originally the instigator of the persecution, succeeded Diocletian, and it continued until 311. On his deathbed, he issued an edict to end it and asked for the prayers of Christians. A power struggle followed this, and eventually Constantine met Maxentius outside of Rome at the famous battle at the Milvian Bridge. It's where he had this vision of a sign that he saw in the sky. It was a sign of a cross, and it said, "In this sign, conquer." And then he had that sign of the cross affixed to the shields of his soldiers, and he went out and had that battle the next day, and they won. And he, ascribing his victory to God, became a Christian. Now, there's a lot of question about this. Books have been written about, you know, well, was Constantine really a Christian? Probably was, but, you know, in this sign, conquer, is that really what the sign of the cross is, that we put it on our shields and we go and we, you know, is that, you know, a lot of Christians have had a problem with that. You know, that actually, that's the sign of Jesus being crucified. It's not something that we make war under. So, obviously, centuries later, the Crusades made a big deal of this sort of thing. That was not a bright spot for the Christian church. But the fact of the matter is, with Constantine, you have the end of a decade-long persecution, the Edict of Milan. And so, if you're a Christian who's been suffering persecution and Constantine emerges as the victor, becomes the emperor, and the church goes from a persecuted status to a favored status and a restoration of confiscated goods and things like that, then Constantine, you're our guy. We like you.
Yep. What little I read about Constantine, I heard that later on in life, when he was much older, he became a little bit more spiritual or serious about his faith when he didn't have to go off and battle to kill people.
He was very interested in theology,
yeah.
And it was at his instigation that the Council of Nicaea took place in 325. Everybody was very interested in theology. He didn't himself formally adopt Christianity as state religion, but it virtually held that status. It did achieve that status, I think, in 394. Toward the end of the century, under Theodosius. Constantine referred to himself as the Bishop of Bishops, but continued to hold the position of the Pontifex Maximus, that's the high priest of the still existing pagan religion of Rome. So this is a tremendous shift, the Constantinian change, it's often called. Some people regard it as the fall of the church, when the church goes from persecuted to favored status, because in some sense the church went from being persecuted to persecutor. If you were a Donatist Christian, you would have thought that way. It paved the way for Catholic exclusiveness in dealing with heresies and sects. There's going to be an official Catholic religion. We're still not Roman Catholic, but Catholic in terms of universal. The church and the state begin to get mingled here, and things get, Theodosius 392 declared all heathen sacrifices to be high treason. So Brian Tierney writes, the church had found a new champion, but the crucial question that arose was whether she'd also found a new master as well. We're now going to have to talk about church-state relations in a way that we really didn't have to before. What's to be the relationship between church and state. The state, as you know, is instituted by God. Romans 13 makes it quite clear that the magistrate, the civil magistrate, is a minister of God. He's got a mandate to do certain things. Throughout the history of Western civilization, that mandate has expanded, sometimes contracted. The church is also an institution of God. They have to work together. That's Paul's argument in Romans 12 and Romans 13. It's not all that can be said about church-state relations, but that's the locus classicus, very important passage in Paul's writings. But then it does get back to that seed thought of Jesus: render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render to God the things that are God's. Sorting that out is now going to be the business of church-state relations over the next centuries in the history of Western civilization.